We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about some of the ways that AIDS, and maybe more importantly, AIDS activists, people who worked on this as a policy, shaped American politics. And our guest for the program is historian Jennifer Breyer. And we'll be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in her book, Infectious Ideas, U.S. Political Responses to the AIDS Crisis. It's a book that's published by the University of North Carolina Press. And in this book, she writes about many different groups that were involved in AIDS work and also their influence on a range of issues, gay and lesbian rights, racial justice, healthcare policy. And she says that these changes and the changes that you can see in this area really offer a challenge to the prevailing view that the 1980s and the 1990s were an overwhelmingly conservative time in American politics. In fact, she says that AIDS policy led to some rather significant divisions on the conservative side of the political spectrum. So if you're interested, you certainly can seek out the book. And here we'll be talking about it and taking your questions as well. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call if you'd like to join in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So whichever number works best for you, at any point here, you can join us. The only thing we ask of callers is just for people to keep their comments brief and try to stay on target with the topic. But other than that, questions, calls are welcome. Again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And our guest, Jennifer Breyer, is Associate Professor of Gender and Women's Studies and also History at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Professor Breyer, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Thank you. I'm well. Thank you for having me on the program today.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. Tell me about the title, Infectious Ideas.
Infectious Ideas, it doesn't refer to anything in the archive that I found, but it seems to me that it really, the title really speaks to a whole range of images that I found doing my research on AIDS, the political response to the AIDS crisis in the 1980s and 1990s. Obviously, what we now call HIV/AIDS, so the idea that there is something called there's a virus, HIV, that causes AIDS, is a relatively it's an idea that didn't begin in 1981, so we didn't know what caused AIDS in the beginning. And I think a lot of the ideas of what caused AIDS were really, people were really struggling to find, to figure out what made people get sick and die pretty horrible deaths. And I guess for me, the idea of infection became something that I wanted to claim, so that it wasn't just that infection is always bad, but that there were ways to use the metaphor of infection to think about how ideas, political ideas in particular, not just medical conditions, not just viruses, traveled from people to people and sort of shaped policy. Mm-hmm. So for me, infectious is a way of picking up on a sort of medical idea, on a biological idea, and thinking about and attaching it to the term idea, really thinking about how it can be something more political. Mm-hmm. So that ideas are infectious just as viruses are infectious.
The other thing that I think is clearly that you're doing is you're encouraging people to maybe think a little bit differently about politics of this time.
Correct.
And using AIDS as a framework to do that. And I think what that gets at is the idea that, you know, we have sometimes in talking about particular periods of American politics, we want to reduce that to a headline. And so,
yeah,
you know, the 80s and the 90s, this is the full flowering of the ascendancy of conservatism. It's not something that started then, but it seems to get its full expression with the election and the presidency of Ronald Reagan.
Right.
And so people think of this and talk about this in a time when in American politics, conservatism was very strong and the left was not as influential, kind of in retreat. And again, what you're sort of saying is, well, actually, if you can use this particular issue as a way to look at it, you can see that maybe that is an overstatement or overgeneralization, or it doesn't really quite tell you what was going on then.
That is really what led me into this project. I was doing reading on the history of the 1980s and the rise of the new right, what historians and many scholars have called the consolidation of conservatism. So before the 1980s, or sort of over the course of the post-war period, the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, we see splits among conservatives, so economic conservatives who are in favor of a kind of laissez-faire, hands-off economic policy, so a libertarian position, and then social conservatives who are more interested in ideas about morality, ideas about the role that women should play in the home and in the family, about sort of attacks on the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, and its attempts to be passed over the course of the early 1970s. And so what many scholars have said is that by the 1980s, those two strands of conservatism become, they coalesce. And they become stronger, and we see the rise of the new right and the moral majority. We see the election of Ronald Reagan. We see sort of major attacks on feminism, on civil rights, on gays and lesbians, at the same time that we see a retrenchment of the welfare state, a sort of shrinking of how the government the shrinking of what the government is prepared to provide for its citizens. All of those things are also coupled with, embodied by Ronald Reagan, a sort of attack on communism, a particularly virulent form of anti-communism. And so what historians have tended to say about the 1980s is that we see this very powerful, sort of all-encompassing conservatism. And that seemed to me... I wasn't sure that I wanted to agree to that. And when I started looking at the responses to AIDS writ large, you certainly see that conservative politicians, conservative activists, everyday conservative people have an effect on what happens with AIDS. But really, the overwhelming sort of political movement around AIDS really comes from people who are opposed to conservatism. And I wouldn't sort of want to gloss over the differences among those groups any more than I would want to gloss over the sort of differences among conservatives. But I really did find incredible political opposition to conservatism in a really wide range of places, including in some ways, most interestingly, how AIDS produced splits among people working within the Reagan administration.
Mm-hmm.
So it's both that there is a kind of opposition to conservatism from the left writ large, but there's also fractures among conservatives, social conservatives in particular, within the Reagan administration, so that it's not just that there's opposition, but there's also, I wonder how much coalescence there is around AIDS, which is what people have historically said AIDS did, is that it sort of invigorated and enlivened conservatism and gave them more things to rally around.
Mm-hmm.
And I've sort of found that's not always the case, even if it is sometimes the case.
Well, just maybe to stay with that, it seems to me that what you're saying is that there was a lot of strain and tension within the conservative movement, in fact, even within the administration.
Within the administration, absolutely.
And among, between people and maybe the people that, the two men that really embody the two poles were Ev Koop, who was the Surgeon General, and Gary Bauer, who was an important advisor to the president, President Reagan.
Right.
And it had a lot to do with it, with how it is one talked about AIDS, mm-hmm. whether education was important and what kind of education, and perhaps overall this really big sort of battle. And maybe it was not just one within the administration, but that had to do with how do you approach something like AIDS, and is the best approach to look at this as an issue of morality and personal behavior, or is it that you need to regard this as a public health issue, set morality aside, and, you know, depending on which of those kinds of roads you want to go down, it's going to make a big difference in the way that you're going to talk about it and what kind of policy you're going to adopt.
I would put an even finer point on it. The differences between Gary Bauer and C. Everett Koop in some ways were quite substantial, and in other ways, I think people wouldn't have immediately imagined that they would have been so substantial. Gary Bauer rose in the ranks of the administration from he began by serving as the Undersecretary for Education, the number two person in the Department of Education under William Bennett. And then over the course of the mid to late 1980s, during the second administration, he moved from the Department of Education into the White House itself to become a senior advisor to the president. He was, by all accounts, his own included, a very strong social conservative who was really part of the new right and the moral majority, considered himself to be, was a Christian and thought of him and thought about that Christianity as being central to the kinds of policies he wanted to see implemented by the federal government and the Reagan administration. C. Everett Koop was also a Christian, and in fact, when he was under consideration for appointment to the position of Surgeon General, he was sort of Democrats were universally opposed to him because they feared that his stance on abortion, he was pro-life, would really affect his ability to be a successful and thoughtful Surgeon General. So in some ways, they seem like they're cut from the same cloth. What happens when they sort of come to work on the same issue, AIDS education? They both believe that we need something called AIDS education. The substance of that education, the positions that each man takes, are really fundamentally different. So while Gary Bauer is really making the case for AIDS education being about a range of things, including morality, what he calls a kind of personal responsibility, all within the context, and he says it quite specifically, of heterosexual marriage, right? So he has this model where the way you talk about AIDS education is through a commitment to abstinence, is through a commitment to marriage, is through a commitment to really constraining the places where sexuality exists, where it should exist. Koop, on the other hand, takes a much different position, one that is almost anathema to his social conservatism, which is that the frank and open discussions about sexuality really need to be central to the federal government's AIDS education. So that has a range of implications. Koop really pushes conversations about condoms, where Gary Bauer sort of regularly, when you read his memos that are held in the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, and there are literally dozens, if not hundreds of them, you see that he is regularly trying to get people to believe that condoms are not an effective way to prevent the spread of AIDS. So they fight over that. They fight over what it means to talk about sexuality outside the context of marriage. So Koop says we need to talk about the way people have sex, not the way we want them to have sex, but the way they actually have sex. And Bauer really strongly believes that the only thing that the federal government should be doing is promoting fidelity and abstinence. And so they really fight. They, while they both the term AIDS education is sort of ubiquitous. Its meaning changes, and how people make the term AIDS education, what they make it substantially about, is very different, and that's what they fight over. So you're right to say that Bauer sort of pushes this AIDS education based on morality, and Koop is really trying to figure out what public health means in relationship to a disease that is clearly spread through certain kinds of sexual behavior, and he really wants to intervene in how Americans understand how they can make themselves, how they can practice safer kinds of behaviors, whereas Bauer just wants people to have sex only within the context of heterosexual marriage. And those are two really fundamentally different ways of thinking about what AIDS education should be about. And the split that they have, I mean, they really sort of go back and forth about what the federal government, not only the kind of information the federal government should provide, but whether or not the federal government should sort of produce its own material that it sends out. And while Bauer really tries to make these inroads on morality, and I would say the other position that he takes is one about the need for sort of widespread testing of people to find out who has HIV and who doesn't. And Koop is sort of fundamentally opposed to widespread testing. He thinks, and this is, of course, before there are drugs that can treat HIV and sort of prolong people's lives, he doesn't believe that testing is necessarily the best way to proceed. So they have these battles over these key areas of AIDS education, and while Bauer really tries very hard to control the content of what Koop says, he's ultimately unable to do so. And so I'm really interested in sort of spelling out in the book that split among those two men, and what it says about the sort of problems of talking about social conservatism as a monolithic group. And Koop really, quite frankly, says that his commitment to Christianity and his interest in science leads him in the direction that is the antithesis of the direction of Gary Bauer.
I have some callers here, and I promise I'll get to them. Then just sort of to round this out, and I'm not even sure this is sort of the right way to frame the question, but now having you just give us the brief overview there, I'm prompted to ask the question, well, who won?
And the answer is, in some ways, each won battles. Neither won the war, of course, because if you're prepared to use the metaphor of the war against AIDS, it's certainly not been won. But each won battles. C. Everett Koop was able to oversee the production of two really important documents that were funded by the federal government, the Surgeon General's Report on AIDS in 1986, and then a document called Understanding AIDS, which was sent by the Centers for Disease Control to 100 million houses in 1988. And that document, much to the chagrin of Gary Bauer and other aides in the Reagan administration, really made the case for condom usage and made the case for discussions of sexuality, and actually sort of had those in the document itself. Gary Bauer won other battles. He won a battle in 1987 in successfully getting the president to sign an executive order, a recommendation that all documents produced by the federal government, funded by the federal government, sort of speak to issues of fidelity and local control. And this document, Understanding AIDS, was produced under a congressional resolution, which basically said that the CDC was authorized to produce this document without editorial power by the president. So Koop won one battle and Bauer won the other. And I would say the other way to answer this question is that AIDS activists and AIDS service providers figured out ways to circumvent Gary Bauer's initiatives to try and control the content of AIDS education. And so while he may have won the battle to control, in some ways, the federal expenditures, provided for AIDS, he did not, in fact, control the content of how people responded to AIDS outside of the federal government.
Right. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Jennifer Breyer. She is Associate Professor of Gender and Women's Studies and History at University of Illinois Chicago and is author of a book that takes a look at the impact of AIDS and people who worked on this issue on political, on U.S. politics, particularly in the 80s and 90s. And she's author of a book on the subject. The title of her book is Infectious Ideas. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press. We have a couple of callers here who have been patient. We'll get to them, and others are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. First caller is in Champaign, line one. Hello. Is there a caller there? Yes, go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I've been listening with great interest. I'd like to comment that any victory of, in my opinion, of any victory of Gary Bowers is a loss to the rest of society. Because it seems like Coop was more dealing with what works, what's pragmatic. He was able to separate his religious views from homophobia or whatever else was driving Gary Bauer, who seemed more interested in his ideas, his ideology, and his religious beliefs than in the common good. So anyway, my question is, you know, this there seems to be this the homophobic Christian is moralistic and is willing to disregard facts and science and what works and pragmatism, and is more interested in making a point and making a moralistic statement versus the scientist Christian who's more pragmatic, who's not homophobic, who isn't driven by, you know, his fear of the homosexual lifestyle or whatever, and is able to see that these strategies work. And that's why we should pursue them. And I would like the guest to comment on that. Thank you.
All right.
I think, you know, that's a very astute observation. There is no doubt that Gary Bauer's deep-seated homophobia fundamentally affected the kinds of policies he wanted to see implemented by the federal government. And the caller is also right in terms of thinking about Coop as a pragmatist. I don't disagree with that characterization at all. What I guess I want to make clear is that part of what happened in the second Reagan administration, so in from 1985 to 1988, we really see Gary Bauer trying with all of his might to institute policies that really do exemplify the kind of characterization that the caller's just made about a kind of ideologically driven policy. And he's, in fact, stopped in lots of places. So Coop is able to sort of do the kind of work that that I've described earlier. The other place where we see in two other venues, we sort of see opposition to the ideologically driven sort of arguments that Bauer is making. The second place we see opposition to this within the federal government or within the Reagan administration is in the establishment of the Presidential Commission on Human Immunodeficiency Virus, or what they call in the administration the AIDS Commission. And Bauer had really been gung-ho about promoting the idea that there needed to be a commission. And in fact, he plays a pretty critical role in getting the commissioners, his chosen commissioners, named to the commission. Although he does at one point write a memo to the president saying that that the president should not appoint a gay person to the commission, he says, because gay people are usually our opponents and not our – they're usually our adversaries and not our allies. And But the president does, in the end, appoint a gay man to the commission. And I think what Bauer is hoping will happen through the appointment of that commission, it's given a very short time frame of 90 days to issue a report, which is sort of unbelievable in many ways, that that an epidemic the size of that the AIDS epidemic is by 1987 could be understood and synthesized in 90 days. But he's really hoping that this will suggest that the Reagan administration is taking a leadership role on AIDS, and given the short time frame, will not produce a document that runs counter to the kinds of ideas that he is promoting. And what happens is, well, first, several people quit the commission because they see Bauer's ideological position as untenable in relationship to what they see as a sort of investigation of scientific fact. But beyond that, they produce a document that really calls into question precisely the kinds of policies that Bauer wants to institute. So the most sort of poignant example of this, I think, is that the AIDS Commission produces a series of recommendations about the relationship between IV drug use and AIDS, and they make the case for widespread expansion of drug treatment. So they're not calling for a war on drugs that looks to control the influx of drugs into the United States. Instead, they're trying to develop a policy or make recommendations for a policy that would basically increase in, you know, sort of exponential ways the kinds of drug treatment provided as a way of dealing with the spread of HIV. So they really call for an expansion of the welfare state in direct opposition to what Gary Bauer is potentially calling for in terms of a strategy of testing, in terms of a strategy of thinking about sort of this question of fidelity or how to promote fidelity. So there is opposition there. The other place that there is opposition is, interestingly enough, in the State Department, and this is what the second half of the chapter three, which is on the Reagan administration's response to AIDS. The State Department really provides a direct contrast to this idea position promulgated by the likes of Gary Bauer. And they really make the case that for U.S. diplomacy to maintain its for the United States to maintain a diplomatic position in the developing world vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, that the United States government really needs to promote the distribution of condoms. It needs to really develop a diplomatic strategy that has AIDS prevention at its center. And the State Department, through a series of contracts that it institutes beginning in 1986 and 1987, really creates some of the more progressive, non-homophobic, non-ideologically driven AIDS prevention and AIDS education, and uses it as part of its diplomatic strategy. So while I agree that this sort of ideological position that Bauer takes, and as the caller called it, a kind of homophobic Christianity, it is a powerful rhetoric, and he is a powerful proponent of that rhetoric. There are places where we see opposition to that, and it's not just in the form of Koop's pragmatism. Perhaps it's the State Department's pragmatism as well, and then these places where institutional bodies like the AIDS Commission try and push back against what Bauer is doing. And again, I would also just say that, and this is maybe in answer to this question about how I try to expand the notion of politics in this book, that part of what I've done, or what I hope to do, is to say that politics doesn't only happen in the federal government, so that there are these sources within the government, within the state's apparatus, that are at odds with each other, but that beyond the government, there are people making profoundly political arguments that are directly in opposition to this kind of ideological stance that people like Gary Bauer and other social conservatives of his ilk are making. Mm-hmm. And to just think that political change happens within the government, obviously we know that that's not true. Historians of even the most recent past, even the post-war period in the United States, know that that's not true, but that people are really AIDS activists, AIDS service providers, a term that I use to talk about both of them, AIDS workers, are really sort of making demands on the state about what it should do, even in the face of the fact that the administration is being advised by somebody who says that the government's position should look like this.
Yeah. Well, I want to make sure that we try and get on to talk about some of that activism on the grassroots level. We do have a couple of other callers. Let's go there. Belgium is next, line two. Hello.
Yes, good morning to you all. And your answer of your last question kind of touches on mine a little bit. Dan Baum, in a book named Smoke and Mirrors that Mr. Inge has had here in the past on, brings out the ridiculousness of the war on drugs, which happened exactly at the same time you're talking about this is in the Reagan administrations and in other administrations before and after. And really, the push on the war on drugs and the push on the inactivity in the AIDS problem comes really down to the fact that they were looking for votes and who they could get to vote and keep them in office more than anything else. Would you like to comment on that?
My hunch is that that's true. I should say, as a historian, I didn't find in the Reagan archives a lot of reference to. I didn't find really any references to how AIDS would be part of an election strategy. That doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It just means that I didn't find it. So, but I would say that that is certainly true in terms of thinking about the sort of general ways that the Reagan administration responded to crises was in some ways to present what I would call a sort of false sense of leadership. And it was leadership that looked at trying to do things, trying to make short-term solutions to long-term problems, trying to think about how to limit the support, mostly the economic support given to social welfare programs in favor of policies that focused on a kind of interdiction, so containing or keeping drugs out of the United States. The same is true with AIDS when in 1987 the Reagan administration is able to pass, to influence the passage of legislation along with collaborator in the Senate, Jesse Helms, to keep people with AIDS, and then they change it to people with HIV, immigrants with AIDS and people immigrants with HIV out of the United States. So that policy, which is instituted in 1987, was just overturned by Barack Obama in an executive order. It had been in existence for over 20 years, this idea that if you keep people with AIDS out of the United States, we will be able to solve the problem of AIDS within the United States, which, of course, is ridiculous because people with AIDS are not only immigrants. There is a national domestic problem that is not just imported from the outside in but exists within the United States. But I think that that's a similarity between the war on drugs and AIDS policy, is this idea that all of these problems come from outside and are brought in. They're imported in, they travel in, they sneak in. And the way to deal with that is to keep these things out, which, of course, doesn't acknowledge the reality of what's happening on the ground, which is that people with – there are U.S. citizens with AIDS, huge numbers of them that are not going to be helped by a policy that keeps immigrants with AIDS out of the United States.
Okay. Again, I want to thank the caller and go on to Champaign County, line number three for someone else. Hello.
Right. Back to the sort of the international dimension. You mentioned the State Department having a weighing in on it. I'm more interested in a later period, which is the whole Bush administration.
Right.
The idea that, but I think there's some themes that are constant, and one of them is the gag rule and the defunding of any full service clinic, you know, which really hobbled funding for AIDS throughout the developing world, where if you're lucky, there might be one clinic in a region, and if you can't fund it, you know, basically by dictating that part of the Christian fundamentalist ethos or whatever, mm-hmm. that you're really limiting, and it caused, I would say, you could attribute a lot of deaths throughout the lesser developed countries to the fact that that was adamantly introduced by, trying to tie that in is just the whole assessment of the Bush administration. I heard Bush is most happy with his presidency as regards to AIDS in Africa, and there are a number of things to point to. PEPFAR is applauded, but it still includes a lot of the dictates of Christian right in it, studying, preaching abstinence, so I'll call it that. But also, you know, Big Pharma was involved too. The Bush administration, Cheney personally threw the table up in the air when the negotiation had gone ahead. I'm trying to remember what year that was, but it just basically this has to do with the later period when there were AIDS drugs, and there was the agreement to deliver them at a lower cost than Big Pharma wanted to do to the developed world. But it was overturned at the last minute, and I think that that's another thing that has to be assessed against the Bush-Cheney administration. And I just the idea that the Bush administration's success in combating AIDS is just, to me, it's surreal. I think they did, compared to what was possible with a real policy, it's even more surreal. But so I don't know if that's clear enough, and it's not actually germane to your book, but I assume that you're probably looking at later parts of the history as well, and I'll ask you to respond. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. I think that's actually a very astute comment. There are a lot of things going on in the question that the caller has just asked. I'll try and deal with some of them. PEPFAR, the Presidential Emergency Plan for AIDS Research, I'm not sure if I have the acronym right, the Bush II administration's AIDS policy, or document sort of plan for dealing with AIDS is really it's a pretty stunning display of what the other caller used the term smoke and mirrors, and I would say that the PEPFAR is in some ways smoke and mirrors. It's an incredible amount of money Bush really called for an incredible amount of money to be spent on AIDS, but as the caller rightly points out, what the substance of that action was. So again, returning to the idea, everybody's in favor of AIDS education, but when you ask them what AIDS education entails, that's where you really get to the nitty-gritty of the disagreement. No one's going to say I'm against AIDS education. And so what Bush was able to do was to really promote this idea that he was fighting AIDS, even though the PEPFAR document has relatively little by way of recommendations on how to deal with sexual behavior. So that the document, I've read the 100-page document, I think it mentions the word condoms maybe 20 times. And beyond that, it doesn't acknowledge the fact that we need to have conversations about how people have sex. So the term if you want to talk about men who have sex with men, which is a way of sort of talking about sexual behaviors as opposed to sexual identities, calling people gay men as opposed to men who have sex with men, those terms do not appear at all in the PEPFAR document. And so I think the caller is really right to sort of think about how there can be the appearance of action on AIDS when the substance of the action is really questionable in terms of what we know is efficacious for dealing with AIDS, the spread of HIV. And I think that really points to what the caller said when he ended his comment by talking about what was possible, what it possibly could have been. And that, to me, is what I've tried to suggest, is that there were many roads not taken, and those roads started in some surprising places, so that the State Department and to some extent the CIA, when it thought about how AIDS affected national security, this is in 1987, long before the Clinton administration, when we start to think about AIDS as a national security issue, those sort of mid-level people in the security state were really interested in saying that we needed to have an effective policy to deal with AIDS, and that that would probably entail condom distribution. It would entail really promoting the kinds of grassroots, on-the-ground work that could be done in the global south, in the developing world, that wasn't going to be imported from the United States, but was actually going to come from there. And I think that that is really a road that PEPFAR did not take. PEPFAR was really about the was really about sort of controlling the content of AIDS education and not allowing it to come out of on-the-ground work in the global south. That the one other thing that I want to comment on, and I can't talk about it at length, but the relationship of Big Pharma, and what he means by Big Pharma is the pharmaceutical industry, and the fact that the pharmaceutical industry has really benefited from AIDS, because AIDS drugs are exorbitantly expensive and have really produced huge windfalls for pharmaceutical companies. I guess the one thing that I would say about that is that Big Pharma, the pharmaceutical industry, has long been interested, not just in during the Bush administration, has long been interested in how it can be part of a solution for AIDS, a sort of drug, a medical-based solution for AIDS and treatment for AIDS. And so that you see in the Reagan administration, one of the things that the pharmaceutical industry does is it lobbies for sort of brand new protections of medical patents as a way to sort of guarantee that it will be able to control what happens with AIDS drugs as they're produced. And so there's really a long history, and I only cover it at brief moments in Infectious Ideas. There's a long history of the relationship between Big Pharma and AIDS work that I think is well worth exploring, but it's just not the book that I've written.
Just about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus. And our guest is Jennifer Breyer. She is Associate Professor of Gender and Women's Studies and also History at University of Illinois Chicago. And we're talking about some of what you'll find in her book, Infectious Ideas, U.S. Political Responses to the AIDS Crisis. That's the title, published by the University of North Carolina Press. We'll try to get at least one more caller here by going on to Champaign in line one. Hello. Caller there, line one. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Congrats on a very challenging, entertaining guest. Yeah, my question is, it seems like between this Koop and Bauer thing, this balance between science, political ideology, and religion.
Mm-hmm.
And seems like the thing about the pragmatic approach is, as taken by Koop, is that in that balance of those three things, science predominates. What do you think?
Thanks. Yes, I agree.
Do you want to amplify on that?
I mean, he says it quite clearly. I would say that religion is a close second, but doesn't, I guess the way I would really answer it is that he doesn't necessarily see science and religion as diametrically opposed. Part of what I think he does over the course of his life, and his memoir is actually quite poignant on this subject, is he manages to really weave these two things together so that for him, Christianity allows for scientific exploration at the same time that it requires that that the fruits of that scientific exploration be utilized in what he would consider sort of ethical, positive ways. So he doesn't see science and religion as opposed, whereas Gary Bauer might see them in, I think, sees them in much more tension. But he also doesn't, he allows his religious ideology to sort of trump or taint the way he reads scientific data. So he's sort of constantly talking about how kissing could be a way that HIV is spread, when in fact, you know, scientific study after scientific study really suggests that that is not the way HIV is most effectively or even, there's like the most infinitesimal risk. So he focuses on infinitesimal risk as opposed to sort of more thoughtful scientific exploration, and uses his religious ideology as a cover for that kind of focus, whereas Koop is much more interested in really fleshing out scientific exploration and allowing it to allowing the results to have more voice in relationship to his religious ideas.
Okay, to Urbana then, line two. Hello.
Hi. Do you get into at all the matter of the HIV deniers? And there was an African-American connection. I'm thinking of Tony Brown's journal and, of course, Thabo Mbeki in South Africa.
Right. The epilogue of the book takes up the question of AIDS deniers as a sort of side point, because the book ends in South Africa with AIDS activists who are really forcefully not only making a case against Thabo Mbeki and his denial that and his idea that HIV is not the cause of AIDS, but who were really fundamentally making the case that the way to deal with the spread of HIV/AIDS is not simply to talk about sexuality alone, but to really think about, and this is an argument that the book makes, the sort of larger economic conditions that make it difficult for people to practice safe behaviors or safer behaviors. So I talk about AIDS deniers sort of in that respect, but not to the extent that other historians have, in part because I guess for me, the underlying, apart from the fact that I don't agree with them, I do think that HIV is probably the cause of AIDS, or is the cause of AIDS, I sort of think, like, what's the impact of their argument? What are they suggesting we should do in terms of prevention? Their pronouncements haven't really been developed in a way that makes it an argument anything other than a sort of just a denial. It doesn't have a positive aspect to it. And it's true that protease inhibitors, the drug cocktail that now makes AIDS a more manageable and chronic condition as opposed to a universally deadly condition, are incredibly toxic. They are toxic drugs. They make people sick, but they also, when taken properly and when taken in conjunction with a proper diet, which also speaks to this economic issue, they really do extend people's lives. And I sort of think I don't quite know what to do with the AIDS deniers other than to say that they exist and that they don't really get us much by way of a political solution to AIDS. Mm.
We have just maybe two and a half, 3 minutes left in there. One thing that this is not obviously not enough time here, but I'm really interested in having at least talk a little bit about how on the left AIDS became a kind of an organizing point, and that it ended up drawing in people beyond the what was initially seen as kind of the constituency or the group that was concerned about AIDS, gay men.
Right.
And I suppose most of the activists initially were white gay men, and about how it is that then other people, lesbians and men of color and people who were involved in, you know, drawn from sort of different sort of groups, how people then drew together and how this became a much, much larger effort.
Well, that is really the second major argument that the book makes. So I would say I'll focus on one example that the one example from the book because of time, and that is really that the fourth chapter talks about the Ford Foundation's response to AIDS and what the Ford Foundation is able to do over the course of the late 1980s and early 1990s is to really insist that AIDS has to be dealt with as a in a three-part relationship, so that AIDS has to be understood in relationship to issues of reproductive health, so that it actually attends to the needs of women who are increasingly becoming a large number, when you think globally, a large percentage of the people affected by HIV/AIDS, as well as dealing with issues of economic empowerment. So the argument that I've sort of just started to make in the answer to the last couple questions. And what they're able to do is really look to a range of actors, and in this chapter I focus exclusively on the grants that the Ford Foundation makes to grassroots organizations in the global south, in the developing world. They're really able to tap into a wide range of activists who aren't just thinking about AIDS in isolation, but thinking about AIDS and its relationship to this question of economic empowerment and gender empowerment, the empowerment of women. And I think that has the effect of really suggesting that the way to deal with AIDS is not just to think about the prevention of the spread of the virus, or even to think about treatment efforts as exemplified by the distribution of protease inhibitors, but to really think much more broadly about what it means for people to be healthy. And in that respect, the on-the-ground activists that are funded by the Ford Foundation, as well as activists in groups like ACT UP, as well as people who are doing work in a range of sort of service organizations, are really trying to insist that an expansive view of health is necessary to deal with the sort of incredibly broad and complex issues of the AIDS epidemic in the United States and the AIDS pandemic globally. Mm-hmm. And so they really are struggling and thinking creatively about how to see AIDS in relationship to these other issues and not just as a single disease. Yeah. And in that respect, I argue that they really move out of a medical model and insist that political solutions writ large are the best way to deal with
Well, for people who would like to explore more of this, you should look for the book Infectious Ideas, U.S. Political Responses to the AIDS Crisis, published by the University of North Carolina Press by our guest Jennifer Breyer. She is Associate Professor of Gender and Women's Studies and History at University of Illinois, Chicago. Professor Breyer, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it, David. Mm.